So first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for the invitation and the possibility to speak here. I want to report on joint work with Kaichi Ulizu, who is somewhere here, I think. And I wish to explain two papers of us called Enrique's Manifolds and Periods of Enrique's Manifolds. I really start, I would like to thank Professor Nicolin for bringing some water and sponge so I could. I hope you can read this. Okay, throughout the work over the complex numbers, and in fact in a complex analytic setting. Okay, our initial goal was central. Clear-cut, we wanted to generalize the notion of Enrique's surfaces to higher dimensions. Enrique's surfaces are a very classical subject, going back to the 19th century, I think. For example, Tolgachev and Kosek wrote a whole book on such kinds of surfaces, and let me start by recalling one possible definition of Enrique's surfaces. Smooth, compact, connected, the usual assumptions. And now the crucial assumptions are first Chern class, the tangent bundle, if you like, is zero in, say, rational cohomology. Let's call it X of Q. And the second Betti number should be with an almost topological characterization. Sort of comes out of the Enrique's classification of surfaces. Obviously, this is not very useful for higher dimensions, so let's consider the broader picture of Kähler surfaces, whose first Chern class is trivial in this sense. Whenever I write C1 equals 0, it means trivial in this cohomology group. Okay. Table, or maybe not here, maybe here. So, Kähler surfaces is Chern class trivial. We have BN surfaces are more general complex tori of dimension 2. They all look like complex numbers modulo a certain lattice. And then we have K3 surfaces. Here I just give an example. Quartic in P3. So there are many others, but they are all at the same underlying topological space. Okay, and derived from this two basic families, we have the following: bi-elliptic surfaces, also called hyper-elliptic surfaces. They are by definition surfaces who have a finite Itard covering, that is a complex torus. So it's A modulo a certain group G acting freely on a complex torus of dimension 2. And then we have Enrique's surfaces. So this are quotient of K3 surfaces by the free action of a finite group, and it turns out that this group is always cyclic of order 2. Also here, one can say much more. The situation is very explicit and completely classified. This is also classical stuff. I think it goes back to Admira and this one sheet, who showed, and here are the basic facts, that the order of such a group is either 2, 3, 4, and 6, and all cases occur. And the abelian, the complex tori, figuring here, are very special. They are always isogenous to products of elliptic curves. They are not always isomorphic to products of elliptic curves, but the action of such a group can be described in terms of such decomposition. No, that's not true. Simply not true. I also thought this when I started to work, but it's not true. It's a little bit more difficult. I mean, in some cases, there are results. If a Abelian surface is isogenous to such a product, it is isomorphic to such a product. I forgot the hypothesis, I think. If there is some complex multiplication on E and F. But this does not mean that the group action here decomposes into a group product action. Okay, now let's look at higher dimensions. To me, it's a very surprising fact that such a table of surfaces has, in some sense, the generalization to higher dimensions, and this relies on the so-called Bogomolov decomposition. Okay, suppose Y is a compact, connected, smooth scalar manifold. Whose first term class is trivial in rational Betti cohomology, then the Bogomolov decomposition says there exists a finite eta covering of Y, so that the total space of the covering decomposes into a product number of factors, and each of the factors occurs in the following list. So these are either complex tori, hyperkähler manifolds, introduced by O'Grady, and Calabi-Yau manifolds, one of the prime subjects of this conference. So let me use the abbreviation CT for complex torus, HK for hyperkähler, and CY for Calabi-Yau. Okay, let me just recall the definition for the sake of completeness. Complex tori always looks like C to G. What you look at is hyperkähler. By definition, the fundamental group is trivial, and the space of holomorphic two forms is generated by a single, this is a one-dimensional form, and this two form should be a symplectic form. So here you have a variation of holomorphic two forms on the tangent or cotangent space, if you like. And Calabi-Yau manifolds, here also, by definition, the fundamental group is trivial, and then we have vanishing of intermediate Hodge numbers. So these are the prime constituents of any scalar manifold whose first term class is trivial. Two remarks. First, the scalar condition in the statement seems to be essential, although I have the impression that it's maybe too strong. Maybe it suffices to assume just the class of category C, that means bimeromorphic to scalar. So this in particular here applies to Calabi-Yau manifolds. We have seen that there there are also many Calabi-Yau manifolds which are not projective in Mallet-Godard embedding theorem. They cannot be scalar. Obtain some small resolutions, say, and that means they are bimeromorphic to scalar. Yes? Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I maybe should add at this. Yeah, I mean, this applies to. This applies to all the three cases. The dualizing sheaf is trivial. Yeah, second remark, there is no algebraic proof of this Bogomolov decomposition. It entirely relies on differential geometry. So I find this annoying. It would be interesting to have an algebraic proof of this. And the situation cannot be completely trivial, because in characteristic P, the statement does not hold as it stands due to existence of Enrique surfaces in characteristic 2, whose K3-like covering is not a manifold. Okay, as O'Grady explained, the Heikra-Kähler manifolds are without doubt the higher dimensional generalization of K3 surfaces. So it is only natural to define Enrique's manifolds in the following way. Manifold is a complex manifold Y that is not simply connected and whose universal covering denoted by X is a Heikra-Kähler manifold. The fundamental group, of course, is finite. I want to remark that almost the same definition was given independently by Boissier, Nieper, Wiskirchen, and Fati, who's also here. Oh, I see. Is that correct? Okay. Here are some basic facts on this Enriquez manifold. The first fact is that they are necessarily projective, as are Enriquez surfaces. The second fact is their dimension is always even. I write it as 2n, where n is the half dimension of y. So this is due to the fact of the symplectic form on each tangent space. And most importantly, the fundamental group, that is the group acting freely on the Hyper-Taylor manifold, is necessarily cyclic. And moreover, it can be canonically identified with the d's roots of unity in the complex numbers. This is here the trace of the representation on H20. So I emphasize it because it will be later helpful to think of the fundamental group really in a canonical way as complex roots of unity. The projectivity comes from the Kodaira embedding theorem. Relying on the fact that y is scalar and that in this situation all real 2-G is filled out by 1-1 forms. Okay, we have now two basic numerical invariants, the half dimension and this order of the fundamental group. We call this order the index of the Enriquez manifold. Sorry for that here, I return to this way of cleaning. The following facts on the index. The index necessarily is a divisor of n plus 1. This just follows taking holomorphic Euler characteristics. And a second bound on the index is that it's all Euler phi function is bounded above by the second Betti number of the covering Hyper-Taylor manifold. This is a nice argument due to Nicodine in the K3 situation. Yeah. Okay, now let's look at an example. For Enriquez manifolds with index 2, this is the simplest case, and n should be at least 1, and by this condition it must be an odd integer. Okay, we start with an Enriquez surface. Let S be its universal covering, it's a K3 surface. Universal covering of K3. And let me write G for the fundamental group. Cyclic of order 2. I write it as the second groups of unity. Yeah. Okay, the group G acts on S, and we have an induced action on the symmetric product, self-product. N of S, metric product is just a sales product n times, modulo the permutation action commuting the factors. It's an entirely topological construction, and the induced G action is necessarily free. The points in the symmetric products are just n-tuples of points on S, if you like, and any fixed point would comprise an even number of points, must comprise an even number of points. So that's here impossible, if n is odd. Three. And the situation of surfaces, one has for the symmetric product, which is highly singular, a canonical God-given resolution of singularities, which is the Hilbert scheme of points, parametrizing closed subschemes of length n. So this is related by Hilbert-Jau map. Since the action here is free, it must be free on the Hilbert scheme as well. This is a hyperkähler manifold called x, and y is an Enriquez manifold. This Hilbert scheme of points these are the basic examples of hyperkähler manifolds given by Bouville, Hilbert scheme of points on K3 surface, and then there's a variant with abelian complex tori. You always, for any integer n, you have an action here and here, that's for sure, but the action is not necessarily free. That's the point. If you take n equal 2, then you just, that's clear. Here I was. Okay, here. And then this generalized Kummer varieties are of these principal examples of hyperkähler manifolds. There are many other examples not isomorphic to such hyperkähler manifolds, but they mostly turn out to be deformation equivalent to these. O'Grady mentioned an example based on the EWP sextic. And besides this and their deformation equivalent, and deformation equivalent manifolds, there are only two other, say, sporadic examples found by O'Grady and based on moduli spaces of coherent sheaves. I want to also get into this. Moduli spaces. On K3 surfaces. Let me be a little bit vague here. We have a K3 surface S. Now consider coherent sheaves on S and have to fix some numerical invariance. This is best done via so called Bucci vectors. This is just the name for an element, which I write in this form. In the even part of the integral cohomology of S. And the entries are called R, R for rank, L maybe for line bundle, and here I write it as she minus R, she chi for Euler characteristics. fixes and polarization. H in the Neron Severi group of S, and here I go the real coefficient. And one has a moduli space called M, depending on the polarization in the multi vector, it consists, roughly speaking, of isomorphism classes of coherent sheaves on S that are H stable. Sheaves on S whose numerical invariants rank this Chern class and Euler characteristics are encoded by the Mukai vector. So there's a way to attach a Mukai vector to a sheaf, and this should be the given fixed Mukai vector. Okay, this is of expected dimension. And this can also be computed from the Mukai vector and certain intersection pairing on this so-called Mukai lattice. Okay, now we seek a situation where this moduli space is actually a manifold and a hyper-Taylor manifold and receives in a canonical way an induced G-action. Okay? And furthermore, this G-action should be free. Yeah, I mean, it's the Chern character times square root of Todd class. Something like this I don't want to get into. Basically, it just takes, in a way, Chern classes at rank. Okay, now there are some, now we have some conflicting goals. So to speak, the problem is this moduli space of H stable sheaves is in some sense a part or layer inside a very big algebraic stack parametrizing all coherent sheaves for this given Mukai vector. And the G-action on S, of course, induces a G-action on this stack, but there's no reason why it should leave such piece invariant. Clearly, it has to leave invariant the Mukai vector and the polarization. And it means the polarization must be somewhat special. On the other hand, we have only for generic polarization moduli spaces which are hyper-Taylor manifolds, so one has to make some assumptions so that ends meet. Here are the assumptions. Suppose the Pica number of the K3 surface, which is covering K3 surfaces or Enrique's surface, is 10, which is the minimal possible number in this situation. Mukai vector should be primitive, that means not a multiple of any integer, non-unitary integer. Primitive. The polarization should be very general. This is the wall crossing business and moduli theory. Outside the countable union of divisors. And finally, the fixed Euler number which occurs in the Mukai vector should be odd. Under these assumptions, one can conclude that this modular space is a hyper-Taylor manifold, compact, smooth, which follows the hyperkala manifolds to some general beautiful theorems of Mukai. And furthermore, it receives in a canonical way a G action which is free. So you can take the quotient and get an Enriquez manifold. Okay, let me briefly explain how these assumptions work. The assumption that the Mukai vector is primitive and the polarization is very general ensures that this is a hyperkala manifold. Now the rho, the assumption on the Pica number, says that up to finite index, the Pica group of S and S prime are the same. So on the covering, there are no new line bundles which are not downstairs. That means that the G action on the Pica group of S is trivial. Hence, so it's a fundamental group of the Enriquez surface, no, therefore it acts. Right. G is, as in the preceding example, the fundamental group of S prime, hence acts freely on the K3 surface. Hence, yeah, and this is part of the statement, acts here on this moduli space. It comes from K3. S is K3, S prime is Enriquez. So here we have now the situation. The G action is trivial on the Pica group, therefore it must be trivial on the whole Mukai lattice, and our polarization and the Mukai vector are necessarily G-fixed. So we get an induced action here, and the assumption that G chi is odd ensures that the action is free. This is very basic. If you would have a coherent sheaf with isomorphism classes, is fixed. S prime. Yeah, so it's the same assumption. It's there. So I keep this situation and now consider the more general case of moduli spaces rather than Hilbert schemes. Which is the same. Yeah, right. That's what I'm. That's the situation. Okay. Of S, the K3 surface. Then, in this situation, it also acts on X, induced action coming from K3 action, and the assumption that chi is odd ensures that the action is free. So now we have used all the assumptions, and this is the result. Very good question. We don't know. We basically don't know. The problem is, one knows that the K3 survey, here the hyperkala manifold, is deformation equivalent to such a Hilbert scheme of points on the K3 due to several papers of Yoshioka, who used the deformation. And it is not clear to us that these deformations are equivalent, so to speak. So that's yes. Yes. That's true, but we can, if you like, yes. Okay. Yet we see no way to prove this, actually. Okay. So So far, I've... Ah, yeah, I was interrupted. Suppose you have a Courant sheaf whose isomorphism class is G-fixed. Then here, over the complex numbers, one easily argues that not only the isomorphism class is fixed, but that the Courant sheaf has a G-linearization, which simply means that it descends from the K3 surface to the Encke surface. Or, which includes that it's the pullback coming from K3. So its Euler characteristic is multiplied by 2. Therefore, this cannot happen if one assumes that the Euler characteristic is odd. It's just an analog of the assumption that N here is odd. And that's the reason. Okay, one more remark. We also have examples for Encke surfaces with indices 3 and 4, not only 2, based on by elliptic surfaces plus Bouvier's generalized Kummer varieties attached to the universal cover to the finite eta cover of bi elliptic surfaces. And let me maybe make a last remark to this subject. The maybe natural idea to look at Hilbert schemes of points on Encke surfaces, of Encke surfaces, or of bi-elliptic surfaces, does not lead to Encke's manifolds. Rather, it leads to Calabi-Yau manifolds. So the Hilbert N of an Encke surface is a Calabi-Yau manifold. There's no way to go to Encke's manifolds. Okay. Let me now come to this. So it's very small. So we thought we have 6, but then we were corrected by Saki, Bossier, and there was a mistake in our computation. So this is a far cry from the theoretically possible indices, and it would be very interesting to find examples with higher indices, but all our constructions somehow use actions induced from surfaces, and there the indices are simply too small, so that approach somehow ends with these indices. Now, let's look at Encke's manifold from a more theoretical point of view. Let's discuss deformations. Of Encke's manifold. Now we fix an Encke's manifold. Why? With half dimension n and index d. Okay, let's deform it. There's a universal, but it's really universal. Let's look at the Kuranishi family. That's the analytic analog of the what is it called? Universal deformation. Family for our given fixed y, which is special fiber in this family, and the base of the Kuranishi family is, so to say, well defined as a complex germ. And here it is actually the case that this is a universal family, and the base is smooth of the expected dimension, theta, the tangent sheaf, and the Kuranishi family, Y2B, is universal. Which simply means whenever you have a deformation of the given Y, then it is at least locally induced from this deformation. Okay, it turns out that one can compute the base of the Kuranishi family purely in terms of closed fiber Y via periods. That means, if you like, as integrals over two cycles, or equivalently in terms of Hodge theory. And what it all boils down to is linear algebra data. Okay, let's see how we proceed here. Let X be the universal cover, that is a hyper-Taylor manifold. And in this hyper-Taylor manifold, we have an action of mu d, the fundamental group, and this induces an action on the second integral cohomology group. Now, it has very important additional structure, the Bobel-Bogomolov form. I don't want to get into the details here. It's a quadratic form defined in terms of the holomorphic two-form sigma. It's actually an integral form, and what it up to scalar comes down to is the intersection n form and taking the kind of nth root out of it. Okay, this is non-degenerate. You can ask for the index, and it has an index of the form with three positive eigenvalues, and then the other eigenvalues are all negative. So H0, 2 and H20 and the Kähler class give rise to the three positive eigenvalues in this situation. Now, whenever you have a representation of mu any commutative group on a complex vector space, you have a eigenspace decomposition. So we go to complex numbers, and then you have a decomposition. Now, this is just linear algebra. The summands are indexed by the characters of the acting group. And now, since our group are these groups of unities, the character group of this group is just Z mod mu D in a canonical way. So we index here with integers mod D. And by the very definition, we have that the H20 space generated here by this two-form sigma lies in the eigenspace corresponding to the identity character, or in this language, to the class of 1. Simply means here on this summand, each root of unity acts by multiplication with itself. This is maybe slightly confusing. It's not the Eins eigenspace, it's the eigenspace is the character one. And I know that it has a signature of the form 2-star, two positive eigenvalues, or 1-star, one positive eigenvalue for d equal 2 or d not 2. Yeah. So if we would have here G an arbitrary commutative group, you would have here the character group. Everything is canonical. Now I have mu d, and now this is just a fact of algebra, that the horms of mu d to C star are canonically Z modulo dz. Okay, think it over. It you see, the Cartier dual of Z mod dz is mu d. Yeah? Then again, Cartier dual, you get back to Z mod dz. Okay, these simple observations can be used to introduce marking for Enrique's manifolds. Very close to the classical situation of Enrique's surfaces. Let us now give us here an abstract copy of these lattices. Give L be an abstract lattice satisfying all these conditions of signature, three positive and the remaining negative eigenvalues, together with the VDC representation, so that if you complexify and look at the eigenspace corresponding to 1, then it has signatures as here above. This can be used to define markings of Enrique's manifold, and L marking is a bijection that respects the form in the representation, so it's orthogonal equivariant map phi should say of Enrique's manifold Y. You take the integral cohomology of the covering K3 surface and map it bijectively to F. Okay, then you can define the period domain of the lattice L, abstractly giving as lines in projective space attached to the complexified lattice, satisfying two conditions. It should be satisfy this quadratic equation, and it should satisfy these positivity conditions, which are all derived here from analogous condition of this two. Yeah, this these are all very classical objects of complex analysis. They are what is called a bounded symmetric domain. Sorry, I forgot that. That's important, yeah. So take here the 1 eigenspace. Yeah, thank you very much. So, no, it depends on the data given by L. Okay? Good. Yeah, these are symmetric bounded domains. They were analyzed and classified by Siegel and Cartan. I think it turns out here we have the type 4 domain in the case d equal 2 and the type 1 domain in the case d equal 3, which is just a complex ball in that case. So we have classical and simple analytic objects here. And now for our Kuranishi family, we have period maps. We can extend the marking of Y to the family and obtain a period map defined on the base of the Kuranishi family and taking values in the period domain, just sending B to the complex line spanned by the holomorphic 2 form, non-zero holomorphic 2 form on the fiber XB. And then one can prove a local Torelli theorem, which says a period map is a local isomorphism, which just boils down to compute the tangent map of this map, and it turns out that the tangent map is bijective. Okay, in this sense, the base of the Kuranishi family is determined in terms of linear algebra data on Y. Here's an application of this local Torelli theorem. It says any small deformation of our Enriquez manifolds, the form Hilp N, the K3 modulo plus minus 1, or modulo space stable sheaves modulo plus minus 1, or these generalized Kummer varieties, the group of order 2, 3, or 4, are of the same form. Which simply means they come from a relative construction done for a deformation of S or A. And this can be just proved by comparing the period domains of here the Enriquez manifold, not L, comes from a deformation of S prime, by comparing this period domain with the corresponding period domain of the Enriquez manifold, or the, in this case, B elliptic surface. Time. In some sense, this is bad news, so we don't get many more examples, but at least here in this case, we get more general moduli spaces that give us. So in the remaining 5 minutes, I want to comment on the global P period map. P, yeah, this is defined on the space I call ML, taking values in the period domain. This is, yeah, moduli space of marked, L marked, should say, in Ricke's manifolds. It's not a true moduli space. Points are exactly what they stand, but there does not seem to be a universal family. Anyway, one has a period map globally defined, which is a local isomorphism by the local torsion. So what is not clear to us is subjectivity of the period map, or at least the description of the image of the period map, as one has in the case of Enrique's work cases. And here also there are some this space here is a manifold, except that it is highly non-separated, so I want to comment on this. Yeah, this depends on the construction I want to outline. For simplicity, take d equal 2, index 2, and half dimension, say, at least 3 and odd. I take an abelian surface, A, equal to the fiber, to the product of two elliptic curves, E and F. Our group G plus minus N, X freely. Yeah, classical description. In one factor, one takes translation, and in the other factor, one takes inversion. So since it's free on the first factor, it's free on the surface. And yeah, this was studied by several authors in the past. And here I take a little variant. I add here in the second factor a fixed element in F, and it should be an n plus 1 division point, but not an n plus 1 half division point. So why? This really does not change the action, it's just a kind of conjugate action. But it is very helpful when one considers the Kummer construction. We call the generalized Kummer variety. It's defined by a commutative Cartesian square. One takes the Hilbert scheme of n plus 1 points in the abelian surface, and one has an addition map to the abelian surface. Here this is has trivial first turn class, but fundamental group is non-zero. This is the Albanese map. So one can kill the fundamental group by looking at the fiber over, say, the origin. This is the group is generalized Kummer variety, and this is true hypertela manifold. So it's a Bogomolov factor at this Hilbert scheme of time. Now if one chooses this point here in this way, it turns out that the induced action here leaves this here invariant. And this condition here then ensures that the action here is free. G is again our group, plus minus 1, is in Enrique's manifold. Now consider inside this Hilbert scheme the relative Hilbert scheme parameterizing n plus one length subschemes lying on the fibers of the projection onto F. So here the relative Hilbert scheme lies in the absolute Hilbert scheme. So this here is just the product of F with the Hilbert scheme of n plus one points on E. And as everybody knows, this has a map to the Pica group, and this map is just a projective bundle. Should see PN bundle over Pick N plus one. Now, what happens if one intersects this Kummer variety? This is the family of PN bundles. Turns out that this intersection is a disjoint union of copies of Pn, so n plus one square copies of Pn, which are moreover numerically equivalent. Classes in the Chow group here on the Kummer variety. Now, it is known whenever you have a hyper-Taylor manifold of dimension 2n and inside a Pn, then you can do what is called a Mukai flop. So you blow up this Pn, then you get an exception divisor which is isomorphic to Pn cross Pn, and then you contract it using the other projection. They give new hyper-Taylor manifolds. With one exception, it is in general not so clear that the result of a Mukai flop is scalar, it's just class T. And this is the final result I want to show. We have analyzed this situation very closely, and we can prove the Mukai flop by hand with respect all PNs is scalar and therefore an Enriquez manifold. Now I'm mixing two things up. One can do the Mukai flop also equivariantly. So if you have two PNs that are permuted by the G action, then this flop descends to a flop on the Enriquez manifold. So here we have a scalar condition, and you get an Enriquez manifold on the node, but the Mukai flop of phi with a single G equivariant pair of PNs is not scalar. Therefore, not projective. So the first result shows that we get here in this module space of Marx and Enriquez manifolds a lot of non-separatedness. And the second result shows that the whole setup of scalar manifolds is maybe much too narrow for this kind of notion. Yeah, this brings me, I should say how to prove this. This relies on here this the established projectivity relies on techniques developed by Debar and Beauvais using maps of Y or two Grassmannians. Now he used maps to Grassmannians instead of maps to PNs, and that is very useful to establish projectivity. Okay, and now I'm at the end of my talk. Thank you very much.